Welcome to this Science Progress podcast. My name is Jonathan Moreno. I'm the editor of Science Progress. And with me today is Timothy Ferris, the author of about a dozen books, including Seeing in the Dark, The Whole Shebang, and Coming of Age in the Milky Way, which was translated into 15 languages and named by the New York Times as among the leading books published in the 20th century. Not a bad list. He was also a former reporter and editor of Rolling Stone magazine. That's the career I wanted to have. He's published hundreds of articles and essays in major media, made three documentary films, produced the Voyager phonograph record, and has been called the best popular science writer in the English language. His most recent book, and the reason that we're with him today, is called The Science of Liberty, Democracy, Reason, and the Laws of Nature, which has just been published by HarperCollins and is getting rave reviews, much deserved, in my view. Welcome, Timothy.
Thank you, Jonathan. Glad to be here.
So I want to read one sentence from the first page of The Science of Liberty. And I want you to expand it a little bit, because I think it does express the essence of your view, and I think it's so important that people make what to most Americans, probably most people in the world, what seems like a distant relationship between science and our prevalent notion of liberal equality in the 21st century. So let me just read this sentence. I'm going to read it slowly, and maybe you can elaborate. The democratic revolution was sparked. Caused is perhaps not too strong a word, by the scientific revolution. And that science continues to empower political freedom today. What do you mean that the democratic revolution was sparked by the scientific revolution?
Well, I think everyone agrees that the changes that we call the Enlightenment produced the relatively democratic world we live in today. About 46% of all humans now live in liberal democracies, which is astonishing change from just a century or two ago. The part that had puzzled me was that when I was at school studying the Enlightenment, the origins of the Enlightenment didn't make much sense. There were dozens of different theories involving hundreds of different thinkers. And after I'd written a couple of histories, it just seemed more and more clear to me that the way to approach the Enlightenment was to ask what was new here. I had been taught that it was reason, but reason, of course, was not new. It's been around for many centuries. And it's also not sufficient. You can reason your way into conclusions that have nothing to do with the realities of nature around us.
Indeed.
Science was what was the new ingredient, and science isn't just reason, it's experimentation. And the more I studied it, the more it seemed to me that this experimentation approach is also at the basis of liberal democracy. So I spent a lot of years researching the book because I thought, well, there must be something wrong with this argument. Some scholars must have, somewhere disproved it, but that turns out not to be the case. The argument got neglected for reasons that have nothing to do with its factual or logical veracity.
And I want to talk to you about some of those reasons, particularly in liberal academia, although I consider myself to be a liberal academic, maybe a little bit later on. But, one of the problems is perhaps that what you, I think, rightly identify as the linchpin of this process was Newton's Principia. And, of course, most people are a little intimidated by the idea of reading something that has a one-word title in Latin. Maybe that's part of the problem. But you draw a line from the Principia to liberal equality as we understand it today. Could you talk that out a bit?
Well, sure. There are a lot of ways to look at it, which is, of course, why one has to write a book rather than paper.
Right.
But science... and science to me means what some people call modern science, which is to say a social enterprise. I think we've gotten a bit confused sometimes by going back through history and finding every case in which a solitary scholar guessed right about something.
Yeah.
That's not really science. You need the whole social thing of laboratories and referee journals and all that. That got started sometime in the 1600s, and by the late 1600s, it was really beginning to become clear, at least to people who were paying attention, that here was this new way of studying nature that disproved ancient authorities. Didn't matter how great the authorities were, Aristotle could have said it, but you could conduct experiments that showed that Aristotle was wrong. And from that, it's not much of a leap to say that, well, other forms of authority may be illegitimate as well. As Tom Paine would later point out, that kings never really want to talk about the origin of their royal line because it always lies in violence, really.
Right.
So I, looking at the Enlightenment, usually it's dated from 1688 when the Glorious Revolution established parliamentary authority in England. But it seems to be more appropriate to make it just 1 year earlier, 1687, when Newton's Principia was published, because that book really sealed the deal. All over Europe, even though it's hard for people to understand, it's a very difficult book, but it became clear that what this book did was to establish once and for all the tremendous predictive power of science. And that was another thing. Mm-hmm. Previously, the intellectual standard had been to explain things, but there can be many mutually exclusive explanations, and and science is really the way you decide which one works. And that's what Newton did, and began the change, the enormous changes in the world for the better,
right,
that have gone on ever since.
You and others have pointed out that life before the middle of the 18th century was almost unimaginable to us, even in the places like London. It was nasty British in short, as people have described Hobbes.
Yeah, the United States at the time of its founding was what would be called a third world country today. When the United States first started being called an affluent society back in the 50s, Americans had less than half the money
they
have today. Yeah. So that's one problem with people's imagination, is that they or not so much imagination, but lack of historical knowledge, is they often don't realize just the difference between the way we live today and the way we lived when you looked at your children and you knew that half of them were going to be dead before reaching adulthood.
Right. You know, the distance from 1687 to 1776, the American really insurrection and Adam Smith, it's no time at all, and yet for over 1,000 years before that, the very idea of progress was really not in the minds of people in Europe. The water wheel, the windmill. If you lived for 1,000 years, you might see them, but people did not have the notion that there could be change and improvement.
Yes, those were you've just named the only two mechanical the entire Middle Ages.
You yourself mentioned the income of the typical person from the hunter-gatherer era through the middle of the 18th century, and the astonishing exponential growth of income, not necessarily a measure of happiness, though you describe the data that suggests that generally people who are not impoverished are happier too. So there was a remarkable sort of congeries of incidents that happened in this 100-150-year period from about the middle of the 17th to the late 18th century.
Yes, it was an amazing period, and we, of course, see this all throughout nature, that although the events leading up to transformations can take a long time, the actual transformations are often quite brief.
Yeah.
And the world turned over rather quickly, but the subsequent scholarship and understanding of that world and what we teach our kids in school has not kept up. And so we're in the rather strange and, I think, somewhat dangerous situation of having a populace here in the United States that is immersed in science and technology, but in which only a minority of the adults understands how science works.
And that they owe their freedom to scientific ways of thinking that, as you say, helped us abandon the notion that priestly authority or a monarchy had insight into the ways of things. This is an incredible leveler, the ability to calculate and demonstrate and to perceive, that any reasonably intelligent person can see, that just hasn't been part of the history of the race for the last 500 years, until the last 500 years or so.
No, it's really, it's a completely different world, unfortunately, a world, not completely different, but it's a much improved world in which educational levels are much higher. And I myself am the beneficiary of that world. I'm the first person in my family history to have graduated from college. I went to public schools, and I'm proud to be a professor at a public school at UC Berkeley today, and there are many fine private schools too, and the combination is really extraordinary. It's one of the reasons that our universities are admired throughout the world.
It's clearly the sector in which we are the unquestioned leader still. But one, speaking as somebody who's taught at a great state university, the University of Virginia, that is kind of imperiled right now. It's a little bit of a side issue, but it's one I'm sure that we are both worried about.
Yeah, the big difference for me, the big dividing line, is between empirical, fact-based thinking, which is science, and dogma. Dogma ruled the world before science came along, and it is still the preference of the majority of people in almost every country, and certainly here in the United States.
Yeah.
And it leads to accidents. You know, it causes you to crash the ambulance.
Mm-hmm.
So if you take an empirical approach to economic questions, as Adam Smith did, then you understand that you need intelligent regulation of markets to keep them fair and ethical, as any good investor will tell you. Unfortunately, this country moved in a dogmatic direction. The verdict of the dogma was that any regulation was bad, and that therefore it's the business of government to keep canceling regulations on the books, even if, as I think often happens, no one in the room at those weekly meetings that went on for 6 years knew what the regulation was there for. As a result of all that, we did, and some other influences too, we've managed to crash the economy. And the problem with that is that you then get a dogmatic reaction of people saying, well, now we know that capitalism doesn't work.
And
the combination is a poisonous one.
Yep. A kind of academic solipsism that you talk about in the book, in fact, in other contexts, but I want to come back to. I was particularly charmed, as I think others have been reading the book, by the passages about Tom Paine. Because I think most people think of Paine as mainly the sort of propagandist of the revolution. And I frankly had forgotten until I read your passages about Paine, about the Age of Reason. Can you talk a little bit about Paine as a scientist or as an observer of science, a correspondent with scientists?
Yeah, you know, it's a great tragedy, and perhaps one of the many reasons that Tom Paine is so underestimated in the United States of America, a nation that he named, is that his papers, his personal papers, were lost in a warehouse fire in St. Louis after his death. And as a result, we don't have any internal narrative of what changed him from a very ordinary, unpromising-seeming young man in England to a revolutionary firebrand, but not just a firebrand, but a person who really understood the virtues of a liberal democratic government that really hadn't much appeared in the world yet, except for pieces of England and perhaps Holland. And as best I can find from reading Paine, the answer to that is science. That he spent some time in London on a little money he'd made, and he became immersed in the scientific revolution, came to the United States, and instantly emerged as a great political writer of tremendous importance to the American Revolution, and writing of lasting value. And there are whole long passages of Paine about science, and they're quite good science writing, and they're still infectious. I noticed, for instance, that Christopher Hitchens has become quite an adept science writer lately, and I suppose that has to do with the fact that he recently wrote a short biography of Paine and seems to have found his way into just how you do it. And so Paine still, if that's true, Paine still works on that level.
We can all participate in the resurrection of Thomas Paine. And it helped me to appreciate, I think about this a lot, the fact that the pantheon of founders were from one end to the other scientists. The first country that was founded by a bunch of scientists.
Yeah, the the founders of this country understood the experimental nature of science, and they always described the formation of the country itself as an experiment.
Right.
And what isn't widely understood is that the way democracies work is by constant experiment. Every election, every passing of the law is an experiment. But democracies aren't always so good at analyzing the results of those experiments. And there's plenty of room for improvement there. But when dogmatists attack democracy, it's really kind of oil and water. I mean, it's often treated as if it were another dogma. And I'm amused by how often academics will fault democracy because it doesn't stand up so well as a dogma. But that's because it's not a dogma in the first place. It's a method, and it is the most successful method of governance ever hit upon by humans, just as science is the most effective method of learning that's ever been found.
And this goes to the point that you make in the chapter about liberal academia and the movement called postmodernism. At this point, we might lose some of our listeners who reveled in postmodernism. But I tend to agree with you that we lost track of some very important ideas in the emergence of postmodernist philosophy in the 70s and 80s. And so could you talk a little bit about what happened and what we need to do to correct this problem? I think it's partly a generational shift that is correcting it as we speak. But it's remarkable how popular these guys were and how misread, actually, I think, Kuhn was, Thomas Kuhn's famous structure, Scientific Revolution. I think the overreading of Kuhn surprised even him. I actually had the opportunity to spend a day with him when I was a young philosophy professor. He was surprised.
He felt that way, too.
He was surprised, and the idea of the paradigm shift and so forth, and he was kind of riding the wave, but vastly overread. So could you talk a bit about that?
Yes. As far as I can tell, what happened is this. We had the terrible tragedy of the two world wars, Europe followed by the Cold War, and this much conflict always does a lot of damage that's not immediately apparent. It has to do with intellectual currents. And what it appears to have done to European intellectuals, by and large, is to have persuaded them that the scientific, democratic world that had seemed to be doing so well going into the 20th century had been proved a failure and even a sham, and that it just led to this hideous violence.
Right.
Now, let me just interject a fact, which is that that was not true.
Prior
to the rise of liberal democracy, the average person was less safe in his home, at home and bed in his little village, than was the average resident of Western Europe at the height of World War II.
Yeah.
So factually, this was not a correct analysis.
Yeah.
But nevertheless,
good data now that shows that life in the 14th, 15th century in Europe was very violent.
Yes, yes. Yeah. So the widespread perception that something of unprecedented horror had happened here wasn't true.
Yeah.
But it drove intellectual circles toward an anti-liberal, anti-democratic, and anti-scientific stance, from which they have not entirely recovered, so that we still have a remarkable number of, say, graduate students being taught to become scholars, without ever a notion of accomplishing something that might actually contribute to knowledge. Instead, there's just a kind of endless reshuffling of a paranoid sense of the world, sort of conspiratorial sense, as if this were some kind of gateway to wisdom. And we had a reaction against it in this country once. It flowered as the PC movement, because Americans had a few years of PC, and then they just decided, as with their usual good sense, that they'd had a belly full of it. And postmodernism has been on the withdrawal in this country ever since. But it's still quite powerful, partly because it has been taught in a muzzled fashion in schools of education, so that we have millions of kids in elementary school whose teachers, they don't mean any harm by it, but they have a vague idea that somehow science has been discredited and democracy is a sham. So you wouldn't want to tell students anything that might inform them accurately about the actual basis of the values and of the society to which they belong.
And I've often thought it would be interesting to try to trace this to the intelligent design movement, because mm-hmm. it's much of the rhetoric of the so-called intelligent design movement is language that could have been, in fact, was used by postmodernists.
Yes.
For example, the fellow who leads, one of the leaders locally of this movement in the Midwest, who said, somebody has to stand up to the experts, quote unquote.
Yes, and we've, and really the anti-science movement in this country, which includes the religious right and the radical left, many other elements, its program is simply to seize on any weakness it can find in the interface between science and society. Now those same folks saw a story in the paper today about how they're adding global warming skepticism to their list just because they sense that there's blood in the water there.
Exactly.
Which there really isn't. But
yeah.
And I think that it's really important for people to do what you're doing, which is to stand up for the verifiable facts of our own history and where we are in this experiment. It doesn't require belief in anything. It just requires an acquaintanceship with the historical facts of how we got to where we are now.
No, science is liberating, as my dissertation director used to tell me decades ago. Let's not end by beating up the liberal academics. Let's end rather by beating up the totalitarians, because I hang around with lots of historians of science and technology, and they spend a lot of time studying science in Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union. And they know better than this, but I think many people think of Nazi Germany and Soviet Russia as great scientific powers.
Yes, I had been taught that too.
Yeah.
And so when I began work on this book, one of my questions naturally was, well, what about Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union? Weren't they real good at science? And fortunately, we have much better availability of the internal records now than we did a generation ago, and they weren't. The widespread claim that socialist systems generally, and even their communist and fascist varieties, were more efficient than democracy, is not true. It's not factually true. And in fact, the phrase was always used for it. Well, Mussolini made the trains run on time. Some good soul had the sense to go consult the train records, which still exist. It turns out that the trains did not run any better on Mussolini than they had before.
Yeah. And yet we think of them producing these vast machines.
Well, it's an intellectual prejudice. College professors seem to imagine, because so few of them have any practical political experience, that the way to run a country is to put together some group of people like them who've read a lot of books, and they would hand down doctrines, and then they would be carried out in the society.
Yeah.
Now, hideously, that experiment was done. And the result in the case of communism, for instance, was the murder of over 30 million of their own citizens through state-sponsored famine alone.
Yeah.
I would like to state an opinion about that.
Yeah.
Which is that if your philosophy is put into practice and it kills tens of millions of innocent civilians,
something's wrong.
You don't get a pass. You don't get to say, oh, well, it wasn't done right.
Yeah.
Or on the other page, I said something else useful. You just are, we're just done with you.
Yeah.
And I don't understand for the life of me why any of this stuff is still taught in classrooms as if it had it was of some use to someone.
No, that's right.
It just isn't. I'm not saying that you shouldn't read it.
As an historical matter, history of ideas and so forth. Yeah.
Yeah, but there's this vague notion, and I saw it just in the Times the other day, someone made this assertion that someone like Jean-Jacques Rousseau, a madman, or Heidegger, who was a Nazi, that these people have much to teach us about liberal democracy.
Mm.
It's time to ask, what is it?
What is it?
Let's see the exact quotes. Tell me where it is, because I don't think you'll get a coherent answer.
Yeah. No, they were, Heidegger in particular, essentially a kind of a folkish mystic. When I read Being and Time in graduate school, and Then I found out a couple of years later that in the translation by a philosopher named Macquarie, as I recall, had hundreds of errors in it.
Yes.
But you wouldn't have known because nobody really knew what the hell he was talking about anyway.
That's right. And the Kaufman translations of Nietzsche were similar. They were simply balderized to make Nietzsche, who was a very fascinating writer, hardly could
write a
dull page, but to make him into a figure that would be more palatable to us. One does not find in any of the Kaufman editions of Nietzsche, for instance, Nietzsche's reverie on creating movie theaters into which the unfit would be led. They would watch a lovely light show while they were gassed to death. That wouldn't have played so well as to the freshman at Northwestern, which is where I was reading Kaufman Nietzsche, and where my roommate changed his major, as the only person in the history of Northwestern to have done this, from advertising to philosophy in order to study Heidegger. And this poor soul spent years trying to understand Sign and Sight, which is not an exercise I recommend to anyone.
No, having been there. well, we seem to be drawn back to bashing the liberal academics, but
I wouldn't have called them liberal academics. I would call them illiberal
regressive,
academics.
Regressive so-called liberal academics. Well, we've been talking with Timothy Ferris, author of a dozen books, including most recently The Science of Liberty, Democracy, Reason, and the Laws of Nature, published by HarperCollins. And it's just been a terrific opportunity to reflect on the relationship between science and liberal democracy, which is not a connection that many people understand. And one hopes that the science of liberty has an impact not only on people our age and a little younger, but also in particular teachers who, as you pointed out, have to convey ideas to our kids. And without over-dramatizing it, the future of the country, I think, rests to a great extent in understanding the connections that that Timothy Ferris has made in this book. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Jeff. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
It's been great, and we will look forward to The Science of Liberty, the second version, further explorations in The Science of Liberty. Thanks so much.
I hope those are done by readers.
Well, many of them will, we hope. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Ciao.